Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks very much for coming. Welcome to this panel discussion event on consciousness, co-sponsored by the Forum and the Centre for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science here at LSE. The questions we'll be discussing tonight are the following. What do we mean by consciousness, and what makes it so hard to explain? Which animals can we say, other than humans, probably have consciousness? Which animals, if any, can we say probably don't have consciousness? And what is the function of consciousness in the lives of humans and other animals? And what, if anything, can we say about how it might have originally evolved? Now, these are really hard questions. I mean, they're probably some of the hardest questions any of us can ask. The guiding thought behind this discussion is that maybe it might just be possible to make a little bit of progress on some of these questions by bringing together experts from philosophy, from evolutionary biology, from neuroscience and genetics, and trying to synthesize their insights into a coherent picture. So it's a pleasure tonight to be joined by four experts who are in different ways at the cutting edge of research in this area, albeit in very different fields. They are, on my left, Professor David Papineau from King's College London, Professor Bjorn Brems from the University of Regensburg, Professor Chris Frith from University College London, and Professor Eva Yablonka from Tel Aviv University. Now, to give you a sense of the format for the event tonight, we're going to focus on each of our key questions in turn. One of the panelists is going to present a few introductory remarks. Then we'll have a discussion among the panel on that question, and then you'll get your chance to put your questions to the panel, and then we'll move on. So our first key question then, what do we mean by consciousness? What is it about consciousness that makes it so hard to explain? To introduce us to that question, David Papineau.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. Can you hear me all right? Is the microphone working? Good. What was the question again?
What do we mean by consciousness? What makes it so hard to explain?
Very good. So I guess for many people, the first thing they think of when that question is raised, they think of self-consciousness. They think of beings, like human beings, that have a sense of themselves and of their minds. We can think about what's going on in our own minds. We have a kind of higher order ability to think about our mental states. And that's a kind of consciousness, self-consciousness. But it's not clear that you want to restrict consciousness to beings who are self-conscious. On the face of it, that would rule out animals and infants as being conscious. So Ned Block has a useful distinction here. He distinguishes between what he calls access consciousness, which is roughly self-consciousness, the kinds of states which intelligent beings like ourselves can tell we've got by introspection, and phenomenal consciousness, which is a more general idea of a state that's like something for the being that has it, something that it's like to have. So if you just think about pains or visual, it's like something to have visual experience. And as Ned Block points out, these two ideas are pretty much different ideas. I mean, at the conceptual level anyway, we can certainly imagine beings who have access consciousness, are able to note what's going on in their minds, but don't have phenomenal consciousness. Those of you who watch Star Trek Commander Data, there's an issue about, does he have phenomenal consciousness? But there's no question but that he has access consciousness. So we could imagine a being with access consciousness, no phenomenal consciousness. And the other way around, we could imagine beings with phenomenal consciousness, no access consciousness, the infants and the cats and the animals that I mentioned before. Still, the fact we have two different concepts here doesn't necessarily mean that in reality they're different things. So there's a question here, which is What are we picking out in reality when we talk about phenomenal consciousness? Let's agree that our focus is on phenomenal consciousness, on what it's like, states that are like something for the being that's in them. And it may be so what does phenomenal consciousness, the concept of phenomenal consciousness, pick out? Some people think that it refers to something non-material. These are dualists. They think that in addition to all the physical material stuff in the world and the complicated machines and biological machines that can be built out of that, there's an extra realm, a realm of conscious feelings that somehow float above, are separate from the physical world. So that's one possibility. The notion of phenomenal consciousness refers to something non-material. The other option is to suppose that the notion picks out something in the material world, some kind of brain processes, neural processes, computational processes. They're the ones that constitute consciousness. They're the ones that it's like something for you when you're in them. And then it looks like it's a kind of empirical question to figure out which are the states that so constitute consciousness. And maybe it turns out that access consciousness, self-consciousness, is the only kind of phenomenal consciousness. Maybe we can set the bar a bit lower and animals and perhaps even insects come out to be phenomenally conscious too. And my colleagues here will be talking about a range of such options. So Jonathan asked, why is consciousness so hard to explain? Well, if you take the dualist option, then it looks built into that option that it's hard to explain. So here's all the physical stuff, and then sometimes, pop, there's some bit of, I'm being a bit partisan here, a bit of magic that causes some mind stuff to pop into existence. And to try and understand that from a scientific naturalist perspective looks by its nature very, very difficult. Suppose you take the materialist option that when we talk about phenomenal consciousness, we're just talking about some kind of physical process, which, as it happens, is like something for you when you're in it. Well, then, if you ask me, it's not that difficult. I mean, perhaps the boundaries are a bit vague, but that looks just like a normal scientific question. And I think, from my point of view, the reason people think it's so hard to explain consciousness is that it's very difficult to be a wholehearted materialist, and they slip back into dualist thinking, and they feel that any materialist story somehow leaves out the real thing, the extra thing, the non-material thing, and I think that's a mistake. So my own view is that the reason people feel consciousness is so hard to explain is because they can't help themselves slipping into dualist ways of thinking.
Thanks very much, David. Let's have some thoughts from the rest of the panel on this. I mean, all of you in various different ways trying to explain consciousness. What is it that you take yourselves to be trying to explain when you do this? Chris?
Well, I'm basically an experimental psychologist. So my question would be not so much to explain consciousness, but how do I study consciousness? And I think this is difficult, except in human animals, because with humans we can ask people, were you conscious? Did you see this face that I flashed up? Did you not see this face that I flashed up? And you can look at, you can do experiments on this, you can see what sort of things can we do, can we learn something about faces that we didn't consciously perceive? We can ask questions about which bits of the brain are active, other bits of the brain that are active even though we didn't see the face, and what happens in the brain when we do see the face. And you can even ask relatively straightforward questions like, are there certain types of other contents of consciousness that for which particular bits of the brain are necessary? So, for example, there are interesting studies showing if you lose a particular bit of the visual cortex known as V4, you are no longer able to have the conscious experience of colour. So that suggests that this bit of the brain may be necessary for the perception of colour, but it's certainly not sufficient for the perception of colour. And then there are other arguments about, do bits of the brain have to interact in order for us to have these experiences of consciousness? And the problem with all of this, of course, is that this relies on people being able to tell you about their conscious experience. They're able to introspect. You have to believe what they say. So I, for example, have been involved in hospitals with people with memory defects, and then you have to know, do they really have a memory defect, or are they pretending to have a memory defect? And then you have to come up with interesting ways of how can you detect whether it's true or not. And so, but it makes it, of course, then extremely difficult to study consciousness in any species other than humans.
I think that one of the reasons that it is so difficult to study consciousness is phenomenal consciousness, that is, the subjective experience, is precisely because it is subjective experience and it is private. It is something, my pain is very much my pain, and it is difficult, and yes, there are behavioral indicators that show that this pain, and other human beings can believe that I have pain, but they do not feel my pain. So how do we study this subjective aspect of experiencing that in a way that is not reliant only on behavior, only on, it has to be reliant also on behavior, but not only on behavior, because behavior alone cannot give it to us. So we go and do the kind of things that Chris has been saying. We compare people who are conscious of something and people who are not conscious of something, people in deep coma and people that are widely awake and alert, and so on and so forth. And in this way we can learn about differences between conscious and not conscious state, but it still leaves the question of what consciousness is difficult, although we can now are able to say something about it. I think that with respect to animals other than humans, we have to ask whether there is something that, for example, animals can do only when we think they are conscious. Or is there anything which is not reported in language that we can only do if we are conscious, and then see if other animals are like us? It is, to some extent, an argument from analogy. And we have to justify this type of analogy. But I think that this kind of approach can help us answer the question whether or not other animals also have some subjective, private feelings, experiences.
I think it becomes very clear why it is difficult to define consciousness when you just listen to what we all here are calling it. So we're using adjectives, which seems to indicate that it's not one thing, because we have phenomenal, we have access, we have all kinds of other adjectives that we use. So if we have to use so many different adjectives, it means that it's probably a multifactorial process. There are probably a lot of things that are taking place. And even if we use different words, such as awareness, are you aware of the image of the face that you have seen, we're already also indicating that these things may even be so difficult that we actually have different words for it. And so if we already have different words for it, then it's probably no surprise that you will be hard-pressed to find two scientists that study consciousness that agree on what it actually is that they're studying.
Or even one.
Or even one. That agrees with themselves what consciousness is.
Do you agree with this assessment, David, that really there's no such thing as consciousness simpliciter, as philosophers say, but rather many, many different properties or with slightly different names that are run together under the name consciousness?
Well, I started off trying to say, look, what people are really interested in is this, I'm a bit suspicious, to be honest, supposed idea of phenomenal consciousness. But just to bring out the difficulty, when Chris started explaining how we study consciousness in humans, it was pretty clear that what he was ending up picking out was access consciousness. So you remove V4 and the subjects say, I don't have color experience anymore, so they have no conscious color experience, we think. But look, in earlier stages of visual processing, the chromatic information is there, all right. So how do we know it's not conscious but inaccessible. And Ned Block, who introduced this distinction between access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness, now thinks that an awful lot of the stuff going on in the brain is phenomenally conscious, even though the subjects can't report on it.
Does he believe that V4 in a vat would be conscious of colour?
His views have got very weird, and I, as far as I understand them, he wouldn't think that V4 is necessary for colour experience, but he would think it's necessary for reported colour experience.
Just to clarify, V4 is the region of the brain associated with visual...
So it's associated with colour
experience.
Is that right? I thought...
Well, it's the bit of the brain that lights up, even in the monkey, when you give it colour.
My understanding was we knew where V4 was in the monkeys, and V4 is a name for the supposed bit of the visual cortex that does colour experience in humans, but we're not quite sure which bit it is.
We do know now.
Okay.
I mean, one of the key questions here, right, is whether a cerebral cortex is needed at all for consciousness. Received wisdom, I suppose, that at least in humans it is, but... people like Bjorn Mercer have challenged that idea. Have you challenged that idea?
Yes, I mean, there is some people argue that you don't need a cerebral cortex for consciousness in humans, and there are people who are born without it, and nevertheless they have some expression of emotions. They respond in ways that we think indicate feelings, and there are other reasons which this Swedish cognitive scientist suggests that argue that the kind of dynamic organization of the primitive bits of the vertebrate brain without the cerebral cortex are such that they allow the animal to choose between different targets in the world, to choose between different actions that are directed towards this targets, and to have a motivation. And he thinks that the combination of these three, the target selection, action selection, and motivation, are integrated and form the kind of thing that we call a self, and that this is absolutely necessary for the animal being able to distinguish, among other things, between actions, between the effects of its own actions and the effects of the world on it. So it is distinguishing itself from the... And he argues, I think convincingly, that the cerebral cortex is not necessary for consciousness in humans, and by extension, that all vertebrates that have this type of organization, and maybe not all vertebrates do actually have this type of organization, but most of them do, certainly most fish do, but not all, possibly not all, are conscious at this minimal sense of being the sense of having a feeling of their body vis-à-vis the world, of being able to choose between things, choose between actions, and to have a motivational system for doing so.
But do the people, the humans with no cerebral cortex, have access consciousness?
No.
Great, okay, so we'll come back to that issue in a few moments. I'd just like to take a few questions from the audience on this topic. What would be great is if we could have a quick batch of three questions. Let's start in the middle here.
I would like to ask again, what were the three aspects based on which we judged whether the animal has any kind of conscious experience? Target selection, motivational system, and the third
action
one?
Action selection.
Hmm?
Action selection. It's not my idea.
Yeah.
It is Björn Mercer's idea.
All right, thank you.
And a second question from the third row here.
Hi there. I'm going to be really blunt and just assume that none of you are dualists. And so having said that, clearly there must be some relation with the material brain or self and this experience notion of experience. And I want to know for you four, maybe you can't agree on what consciousness is, but maybe we can agree on where this actual mapping lies. So clearly subjective experience has a structure, and the material activity has a structure as well. So where do you think the bridge lies? In what form?
So you started your question by saying you assume that nobody here is a dualist, but then the rest of your question sounded 100% dualist to me.
Let me emphasize this seemingly subjective or non-physical notion of experience. Because when you're experiencing something, clearly you don't feel physically your experience. You just experience. And I think that is also why people are inclined to be dualists, because it just does not feel materialistic.
So I'm going to state my materialist view, but I know it's going to sound weird, but I just take that to be an index of how difficult it is to believe materialism, how natural it is to slip into dualism. So I think that ideally we'd find that certain kinds of physical processes, brain processes, Eva's theory is any brain processes that involve certain kinds of associative learning, constitute consciousness, that if you have a brain process like that, it's like something for you. Now, I don't think there's two things, the brain process and the experience. I think the experience is just that brain process. They're one and the same. They're one and the same thing. And sometimes I say to people, well, what would you expect it to be like to have a brain process like that, to be kind of nothing, to be colors? Well, I mean, this is what it turns out to be like. It's like having experience. Now, the natural response is to say, but no, you haven't really done the job. You haven't told me why those physical processes give rise to these feelings, why they go with these feelings rather than other feelings. And my response is, no, once you start asking that question, you're already a dualist. There's no question about why this process, brain process, goes with something else. The feelings are the brain process. It's like asking, why does Mark Twain go with Samuel Clemens? I mean, it's not a good question.
Are you familiar with a concept of dual aspect monism? It is a view that quite some researchers actually adhere to, is that there is nothing else than material. However, the same thing can be viewed from two perspectives, from the subjective point of view and from a scientist point of view. An ideal omniscient scenario, you could have your own actual experience, feel it, and be aware of it, its full structure, at the very same time with some magic equipment, see the exact brain processes. And this is not dualist at all, because the simple fact that you have a feeling already implies that there is a feeling. This is not saying there's an extra ingredient.
Let's perhaps not get into the finer details of this. Okay. Unless you'd like to, David.
I'm familiar with dual aspect mode. If all you're talking about is two different ways of thinking about the same thing in reality, well, of course I'm on board with that. We have the everyday concept of consciousness, and we have whatever it is, unrestricted associative learning. But there's just one thing in reality. If you say that thing in reality has two aspects, then that's dualism.
I wonder if any of the rest of the panel wants to confess to being a dualist, or do you accept the challenge of being...
Well, I discovered today that I'm an interactive dualist.
I'm afraid so. One thing you said committed you to that. You can take it back.
So, David, what about zombies? Do you, your view is that philosophers have this term zombie, the idea that it's conceivable that there is an organism that is physically identical to you but that lacks conscious experience. So, David, your view is just that's not possible.
It's conceivable, but not possible. I mean, it's conceivable that H2O not be odorless and colorless, but it's not possible. I mean, it's...
Okay, great, thanks. Let's turn now to our second key question. You know, I mean, we could talk for hours on that, but non-human animals, consciousness in non-human animals, to what extent is it reasonable to ascribe conscious experiences to animals that are not human? Can we say that some species of animal probably are conscious? Can we say that some... probably not. How do we begin to address that question? Bjorn, would you like to introduce us to this?
That's an interesting question posed to me, because I'm probably the one the farthest away with my expertise, the farthest away from consciousness, studying invertebrate animals mostly. And because it is so difficult to define and explain what consciousness is, and because everyone sort of, even those that don't think about it all the time, everyone has sort of their own idea what it actually means, and very few people can agree. That's why I can easily take the stand of saying, well, the kind of consciousness that I'm thinking of, only humans have. And One can see it a little bit analogous to language. That means it didn't fall from the sky. We can study some aspects of language in songbirds. We can study other aspects of language in the communication of other animals, maybe of apes that we've trained to use signs to communicate, maybe parrots. So there's a lot of different aspects to language that we can study in other animals without actually saying that these animals have language. And I think similarly, we can study, and because, of course, also as a final argument, because it appears as if what we generally call consciousness is a conglomerate of all kinds of brain processes that interact, one can look at what are some of the important aspects of consciousness and where do they come from. And one of the things that seems to be a prerequisite that has already been mentioned by Eva before is the concept of a self. The concept of a self as an entity that is somehow distinguishable from everything else that is non-self. And that appears to be a very fundamental distinction. And if you do experiments with all kinds of different animals, it turns out that the processes by which animals make these distinctions apparently are quite similar across all kinds of animals one looks at. So one of the things that's probably most striking, or that was most striking for me at least personally, is to realize that this concept of a self that we take as a given is actually something that develops, or at least appears to develop. It has all the hallmarks of something that, of a process rather than a state. Because if you interfere with it, what you find out is that a lot of the psychiatric disorders can actually be traced to something that's wrong with our concept of self. And if you go to the etiology and if you go to the causes of various of those disorders, what you find is that very often there was an event or a biological process or a genetic disorder that prevented this process from occurring normally. And one of several processes that generates this sense of self versus non-self, this distinction, is one where the iconic phenomenon is the one that we can't tickle ourselves. It's that we have and it looks as if most, if not all, central nervous systems that have evolved over the millennia and millions of years have evolved and possibly from a common ancestor, but possibly only evolved once, we're not quite sure about that, but it looks as if it only evolved once, a way of distinguishing seemingly identical stimuli and interpret them completely differently. So tickling is one of those things. If you just turn your head 90 degrees to one side, then you have just noticed that the entire room moved 90 degrees in the opposite direction. And yet, you did not have that experience. You had the experience that it was your head that actually moved. And this distinction, your eyes, there's a good case. Your eyes, in principle, your eyes don't know that what just moved across your field of vision was not a moving room, but a turning head. In principle, it's probably a lot more complicated than that, and some parts of your visual tract, in humans I'm not quite sure how far it goes, in flies I would know a little bit better, actually does know that. And so one of the processes by which that happens is trying out. So the process by which we learn what is it in our environment and what is it in our sensory stream, we have all these different senses and all this information is coming all the time. And somehow we always know very clearly what it is that I did and what it is that someone else or something else did. And this happens by cross-correlating, essentially, our own actions that must be spontaneous. They have to, if our actions were caused from the outside, we could not be sure that what we perceive as a consequence of those actions are actually under our control. Now, this raises some difficult philosophical questions that we may go into in the Q&A, maybe. But the mechanisms that arise from the possibility of generating actions and then evaluating the feedback that comes back are being understood on a more and more detailed neuronal and genetic level. And some aspects of those, if we look at the genetics, appear to be conserved between animals as different as humans and flies. So there are genes that are known to be specifically involved in, let's say, the generation, the acquisition of language in articulation, which is essentially such a process, at least on the superficial level, it looks as if, and this was something that was already recognized by Skinner, as if we produce utterances when we babble, for instance, as infants, and then we hear that da-da-da doesn't sound like daddy, what of course every child wants to say first is daddy, and then da-da-da doesn't sound like daddy, I have to change something, and eventually it becomes daddy, and it becomes very stereotypical. And those, this realization, this learning that, okay, this is what I have to do to control my sensory input, my self-generated sensory input. These mechanisms appear to be conserved because there are genes like the FOXP2 gene that seem to be specifically involved in these kinds of processes. And if we manipulate those genes in fruit flies, the relatives, the so-called orthologs, the relative genes in fruit flies, we can manipulate analogous processes that don't have to do with saying daddy, obviously, in flies, but analogous feedback-based learning processes in very much the same way. And so there are components and prerequisites for consciousness that one can study in other animals, but I don't think that consciousness as a whole can be found anywhere other than in humans. I'm not even sure. I cannot even say with absolute certainty. I'm pretty confident, but I cannot say with absolute certainty that anybody except for me has consciousness. So how could I say that about animals?
Thanks very much, Bjorn.
I disagree. So I think that the kind of consciousness that we were talking about, which is like, smelling a ripe banana or feeling pain and things like that, is experienced by many animals. Now, this is this sounds like a kind of an intuition that a lot of people share because of the behavior of animals. Because when you kick a dog, it screams, and it has. And we also know that it is very similar to us in many, many other ways. However, the argument from analogy is a good argument up to a point, because as we go. As we compare animals that are very different from us, they are really different in every aspect, in the aspect of their behavior, in aspects of their behavior, and in aspects of their neural organization. So one of the big questions is, can we have some kind of principled answer that will tell us whether an animal other than a human being is having some kind of subjective experiencing? And I think and there are a lot of different people have different criteria that have been suggested. Me and my colleagues suggested that a good criterion that satisfies quite a lot of, that requires from a system to have many of the properties that we assign to a conscious kind of animal is something that we call unlimited or unrestricted associative learning, which is a kind of type of learning which requires the formation, the generation of compound percepts, compound actions, and the integration of information from these actions, from this of compound actions, compound percepts, their storage in memory, and their retrieval, and this can be based for further learning. Now, it sounds quite complicated, but in fact, many animals show this kind of learning. And we think that most vertebrates, some arthropods, and a few mollusks, some of the cephalopod mollusks, the squid, the octopus, and the cuttlefish, show this type of learning. They have the brain structures to implement it. They have the complex dynamics which is, we believe, what this learning requires, and it also, and this type of learning can only happen in an animal that has an overall bodily and neural organization that gives rise to consciousness. This is our argument, and it is a complex argument, which I will. But basically, we believe that consciousness is quite widespread, although not only in three phyla. Are we sure that it exists among 36 animal phyla, which is only a small number of phyla? We think that it evolved very early in evolution, that it has origins already in the Cambrian explosions, in the arthropods and in the vertebrates, probably separately, in parallel, and that it evolved in the cephalopod mollusks that I mentioned 250 million years later. And this is if one accepts the kind of criterion that we're putting forward.
Yes, I think I disagree with both speakers. But I think there are perhaps beginning to be ways in which we can start to look at human-type consciousness in other animals. Because, of course, when I do an experiment with people, they don't actually need to use language. So I can say to somebody, they have to give a report, like, did you see the face? Or how confident are you that you gave the right answer? And they can press a button. And there are certainly beginning to be experiments done with monkeys and rats along the same lines. So a monkey can learn, has to remember something, that an image is shown, then after an interval two images are shown, the monkey has to say, which image did you just see? And if they get it right, they get a reward. And if they get it wrong, they don't get a reward. But you can add an additional button, which is basically to say, I don't know. And the idea is that if they can use that button, they know something about their state of memory. And indeed, monkeys and rats, in using various paradigms like this, can use the so-called report button, which means that they get more reward because they only answer the questions that they know the answer to, and they omit the questions that they don't know the answer to. Of course, people argue about this and say maybe there are low-level mechanisms of association learning that enable them to do this task, but at face value, it looks as if they are able to give a report about their experience.
So I disagree with all of you.
That's why it's so difficult.
Indeed. So here's the worry. So Bjorn has the view that consciousness is only there in humans with their high-level abilities. Chris thinks it goes a bit further down to the monkeys who can self-monitor whether they're sure or not. Yes. Eva has it going all the way down to any animals that can do associationist learning. Eva mentioned somebody who put it even further down, any animal who can select an action based on targets, whether or not they can learn. Now, I think these are all very interesting categories, all important. We're going to come to it later in the evolutionary context. But I worry if there's any substantial fact of the matter about which one draws the line between conscious and non-conscious in the right place. And I just worry that the reason we think there's a sharp line to be drawn is because we slip into thinking in dualist terms. And if you're a dualist, of course, there is a sharp line between the processes that generate the extra magic and the ones that don't. But if you put that to one side, there's a lot of different material processes important for the animals that have them to various degrees, and I'm not sure there's a clear line between the conscious and non-conscious ones.
I think that the question of whether there is a sharp line or not a sharp line is to be distinguished from the question of whether at some point an animal is conscious. I agree that as an evolutionary biologist, when we are looking at the process of evolution, there are many, many gray areas where we don't know. And all we see is partial things. If we're thinking about on the analogy to the evolution of life, for example, is something a living system or not a living system? A very, very simple system? Is it too simple to be alive, or is it already alive? I mean, this kind of questions, for example, is an RNA molecule that is only 5 nucleotides long and is for some reason replicating itself, is it alive? I mean, people wouldn't think it's... Nobody can answer this kind of question. But from a certain point in time, we agree that something is alive. And in the same way, I think that although you're right, and there is a huge gray area and there are many, many processes, at some point we should be able to say, well, this animal is conscious. Before that, we really don't know. But being able to say that this, that a particular type of animal or an animal with a particular characteristic is conscious is an important, would be very important if we would agree with something like that.
The notion you introduced there of minimal consciousness is absolutely crucial for you, right, isn't it?
It is, yes, because I don't want to think about reflective consciousness of humans, about the ability to think about what we do, about my ability to think about my pain. I think a baby feels pains without thinking, oh, I feel pain.
You perhaps even agree with Chris and with Bjorn on that, that these higher level capacities are much more likely to be uniquely human.
I think the high level capacities definitely are very, very human and they're enormously interesting. They're game changers in terms of evolution in every term. I mean, I think that also our emotions are very different from the emotions of other animals, and it changes us in profound ways. But the basic consciousness, the minimal consciousness I'm talking about, is something very, very... what I'm trying to answer is something to wonder about or to study is something very fundamental. And that is this basic phenomenal consciousness that the feeling of pain, as I said, the ability to see and not just process wavelengths, not just the processing of information, but this very subjective feeling. This is what is so hard and so challenging about it.
This discussion reminds me a little bit of a discussion that one would have. It's a little bit about the blind people and the elephant, right? Or about when you would call something a car, right? And so I don't think there will be any sharp line ever. Just as, you know, if you would be sitting here, would say, well, a fully functional car needs an engine. That probably, you know, more or less easy to agree. But then again, one of us may say, well, you know, if I'm downhill, I can use a car as long as it has a steering wheel. So the steering wheel is the most important thing, right? So if consciousness is something like a process that's composed of several different processes, we can probably define some of those processes, find them in different animals, and then, you know, eventually agree on saying, well, you know, there are certain important parts missing, but that still doesn't mean that in the end, I will have a clear line.
I wanted to introduce something related but slightly different, which is the question of animal welfare. I mean, which animals do we owe some moral concern? And now I agree that with even... A sharp line is not. I mean, you're not going to get a sharp line as long as we're materialists. But I mean, there might be a pretty important border, and I guess the border between things that we don't have to worry about their suffering and things that we should. That's an important border. Now, here's a slightly radical idea. Many people think, well, first you should decide the question of who is phenomenally conscious. And those are the ones that you should treat well. And I'm suspicious of having a methodology to even draw a vague line along those lines. But here's a different... You could think, without raising the question of consciousness, which animals are complicated and sophisticated enough to merit being concerned about their welfare, their suffering, what's happening to them. And maybe that's a good reason for drawing a line and saying, this kind of cognition is important. We should think about the welfare of animals who have that, and these ones are too simple for us to be concerned about what happens to them. And that's a way to draw a line.
But even that becomes extremely complicated very quickly, because you can establish about a whole host of animals. You can all take all those criteria that we learned about today, for instance, about pain and suffering, and you can establish that yes. it matches all those criteria that we've set up. Yeah. And you can do this, for instance, for that's the classic example, you can do this for honeybees. They do this avoidance. They remember all kinds of things about positive and negative events, all these kinds of parameters. But yet, if these animals are drinking from a sucrose solution, you can cut off the abdomen, and they will keep drinking just fine. And they will do so almost indefinitely, because there will be no feedback about their crops or their stomachs being full. So it always, by trying to tie a moral argument to a scientific investigation, you quickly open yourself up in having to weigh against which experiment now is do I value higher than another experiment. So this bunch of experiments that shows that animals avoid pain, that you know, in this case honeybees avoid pain, they remember the pain, they try to, you know, they rub themselves in the places where they've been injured, all those criteria. Do you believe those more, or do you believe the other experiment that seems to indicate that they're completely oblivious to all of that if I just do it a little bit differently?
Well, I mean, there's some things that cause them. I mean, the bee research now shows that bees can be fearful, they can become anxious. And, I mean, Lars over there gave a wonderful talk this morning, and my impression is that knowing what he does about bees, he does take some care with how they're treated. He doesn't. I mean, maybe there's some freaky thing about bees that you can cut the abdomen open and doesn't bother them, and there's things you can do to humans that doesn't bother them. Perhaps that's all right, but the things that do bother them, you perhaps should be cautious about doing it.
And we should err on the side of caution, right? That, you know, if we treat an animal as if it merited moral concern and it doesn't, then we haven't really lost anything.
Well, that would entail that all you have to do is one single experiment that would merit that, and you have 100 different experiments that would show the opposite, and you err on the side of caution.
Yeah.
We could make that case for plants. You could make that case also, probably, if you find one experiment, if I have to think, or at least use the literature, you could do that for bacteria too. You end up very quickly with a whole host, with a real major problem, because you're only allowed to drink water. And you have to cook it before to make sure that, you know, there's nothing live in it.
Well, I think that, you know, we're not relying just on one experiment and on one behavior. We are trying to rely on some kind of a combination of neurobiological and behavioral and cognitive aspects of the biology of the animal to make a decision about this kind of things. So it is possible that a bee reacts to pain in a very, very different way, and because there is no feedback, there is no feeling of pain. It doesn't mean that in other contexts it doesn't feel pain. Good. So we have to understand how the animal works, and to understand it at many levels, not just the level of behavior. It is not just one behavioral experiment that will decide this question. It never does. So I think that if we have a principled way of actually trying to look at this, at how the animal works and how it reacts to different stimuli coming from the world and from its own body and so on and so forth, maybe we can be able to answer to put together these two behaviors and say, well, they are not really contradictory. This is the type of behavior that is special, that is specific to a bee, rather than we humans. If you cut our abdomen, we scream, but the bee does not, because it is differently organized at this level. But at a deeper level, in different circumstances, it does feel pain. I mean, you know, this is a possible answer. I'm not saying it's true. It's possible. But we have to take a lot of evidence into account in order to answer this type of questions.
Thanks. So at this point, I'd like to take a couple of questions from the audience on this topic of animal consciousness. Let's start here at the front row, and then we'll immediately go back to the very back row.
I'm a scientist, and for 50 years I've been studying. And I've come across this kind of debate many times, and I've never really come to any conclusion about it, except that you are either conscious or you are unconscious, and that's an end of it. Now, the problem is that saying, we're all humans, human beings are special. They've got consciousness. Well, if you think about that, it is mere flattery. And once you've flattered the people about something questionable, you're there. And so for every science starts with philosophy, and they've all dropped philosophy. You never hear a scientist talk about philosophy. That is because it's facts.
We have several scientists talking about
and philosophers this. Avoid facts.
Can we go to the back row?
It seems that the cerebral cortex is important because, you know, consider the following. There's something that it's like to control your breathing, to control your diaphragm. There's a certain kind of, for want of a better term, like oomph to it. You can consciously do it. Whereas on the other hand, there's nothing that it's like to beat your heart. It just does it totally unconsciously. Well, what's the difference between those two processes? Well, I think, from what I know, I'm no expert. The diaphragm is sort of it goes through the executive functioning, namely the cerebral cortex. Surely then, those processes which we're aware of, those processes that go through the prefrontal cortex or dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, are the ones that we're conscious of. Would you then, if you don't agree with that, do you think that there is something it's like to beat your heart, but we're just not phenomenally connected to that process? Just the brain stem is conscious of it, but we're not. Do you see where I'm kind of going with that? Or?
And can I have a third question as well, if there is a third question? Great, thanks.
A couple of questions. One, I'm not sure if you're going to talk...
One question.
One question. Okay, so... Do you think we're mixing up the idea of intelligence and consciousness? So is there a level of... So obviously Stephen Hawking, I would imagine, is way more intelligent than me, but I wouldn't say he's more conscious than me. So when you look at a cat or a bee, are we just mixing up intelligence and consciousness, if that makes sense?
All right, thanks very much. Yes, so an important question, I think, about whether science needs philosophy at all. Right? And a question about revisiting that issue of whether the cortex is necessary for consciousness. If so, why are we not conscious of our... heartbeats in the cerebellum, and then a question there about intelligence and consciousness. Responses from the panel? We'll start with Ada, perhaps.
Well, the evidence from people who are born without a cerebral cortex suggests that they are suggest, according to the criteria of the people who look after these people, who are very, very handicapped people, of course, suggest that these people have some forms of feelings. So, and we're talking here about something very, very fundamental. Do they feel some type of pleasure? Do they feel some type of pain? These are the kind of things that we're asking. Do they feel something when they are touched? And the evidence that comes from the studies of that comes from studies of such people suggests that they do. So obviously they cannot do very much. They cannot learn. They cannot. They are very, very, very handicapped people. But this is the kind of evidence that suggests this. Now, I think so. This is the answer. This would be my answer to this question. And we must also remember that all kinds of animals that do not have a cerebral cortex do have very complicated kinds of behavior that go beyond the control of heartbeats and other physiological functions. So we might ask ourselves, how, without a cerebral cortex, are they able to do that? What is the brain organization that is necessary? I think that the cerebral cortex is, once it exists, it exerts a huge control over every other bit of the brain. But and therefore, if there is damage in an adult human being, it can well become unconscious But this is a different question. I want to say something about the question of intelligence. In the 19th century, people identified intelligence and consciousness. So when you're looking, for example, at Romanes, who wrote three big books on animal behavior and cognition in the 19th century, he thought that intelligence is an indication intelligence that is behavior that goes beyond very, very simple, what he called reflex behaviors, are an indication of consciousness. Now, I think that after the cognitive revolution and the computers, we can see that we can dissociate these things. This dissociation is the product of this technological revolution that we underwent. The question, however, is there in animals a relationship between intelligence and consciousness? And I think that the answer is yes, there is. In animals.
Shall I do science and philosophy? It's kind of my thing.
Sure.
Okay. So I think science often needs philosophy. So you might think philosophy is defined by its subject matter, morality, theory of not. I think it's just defined by the kind of problems it deals with. So philosophy comes in when you have a kind of theoretical paradox, like free will's impossible given determinism, but impossible without it, or the mind must be separate from the brain, but it can't be. And I think paradoxes like that arise right within science too. So the interpretation of quantum mechanics, the wave packet's got to collapse, but that's inconsistent with Schrödinger's equation. Or in biology, evolution of altruism, it requires something like group selection, but group selection is impossible. And so you get paradoxes within scientific subjects, and if you ask me, scientists aren't always very good at dealing with them. They aren't trained to kind of analyze theoretical contradictions. They're trained to do experiments to resolve problems, and some scientific problems, like interpretation of quantum mechanics or evolutionary altruism, aren't problems that call for more data. We have all the data we could want. We need to unravel the theoretical contradiction, and philosophers are trained at this kind of thing. They're better at it. As I said, scientists tend not to like that kind of thing. They often leave it to the philosophers. Except when it comes to mind and brain and consciousness.
And then they hate what they hear.
They tend just to avoid it. When it comes to consciousness, the scientists don't seem slow to step in and start theorizing about consciousness. But even in that case, I think they could use the help of the philosophers. So.
No, I've been a scientist for a very long time, 50 years or something, and I now have a desk in the philosophy department, so I clearly think this is a good thing. But I wouldn't like to say why. But this question about the heart, I could maybe add something to that. There's a lot of work recently on the ability to detect the heartbeat, and people are actually quite good at detecting their heartbeat, and you can measure this quite accurately by playing rhythms and asking people, is this actually your heartbeat or not, simultaneously. And some people are pretty good at this, and we also know that it seems to depend on insular cortex, which seems to be a bit of the cortex which is particularly to do with signals coming from inside the body, which would include the heart, stomach, and so on and so on. So that we know something about this. But this is, of course, different from the control of the heartbeat. So there does seem certainly to be an involvement of cerebral cortex in being aware of internal states like heartbeat. And finally, to the intelligence question, this is not quite the same problem, but I'm very interested, as you already heard, in metacognition. That is the ability to know whether I'm right or wrong. So you can do an experiment where you have to detect a visual signal, and you can ask the question, how good is this person at detecting visual signals? Which might be, you could call intelligence. And then you can also ask, how good is this person at knowing whether they could correctly detect the signal or not on a trial-by-trial basis, which you might call consciousness? And they are independent. You can be very good at detecting the signal and very poor at knowing how good you are at detecting signals.
So let's move on now to our third key question then. What is the function of consciousness? How did it originally evolve? I might add to that, how many times has it evolved? Ava, tell us the answers.
can tell you about speculations. Well, I think that the question about the function of consciousness is a little bit misleading. And the reason that I think that it is misleading is that I don't think that consciousness is an epiphenomenon for one second, but I think that consciousness is like life, you will not ask what is the function of life. Life is a goal-directed and a goal-directing system. There are many, many things within a living system that lead to that have functions because they contribute to the function of the system as a whole. So functions are defined with respect to a goal-directed system. I think that consciousness is a process that involves a kind of goal-directing activities within an organism. William James said that it is a selecting process. Selection not in the necessarily in the Darwinian sense, also in the sense of excluding a lot of possibilities and homing on a particular one. And I think this is of the right kind of intuition. So I think that consciousness is a system of goal-directed and goal-directing system, and the kind of things that implement this system have functions. They define goals. They define goals with respect to particular environment. Go to this place because there is water there. Fulfill this desire in this way, and so on and so forth. So I think that consciousness for me is, a goal-directing system which is a framework for ontogenetically constructed goals. Life is a system with phylogenetically constructed goals, survival and reproduction. Of course, everything has in the end to serve survival and reproduction. So if you want to assign some kind of function to consciousness, we can say, well, consciousness has the function, I wouldn't say that, but if you want, okay, has the function of generating ontogenetic goals. It's a goal there, this is what it does. And that's why it was selected during evolution. And that's why I believe that it was selected within the context of the evolution of this complex associative learning. It's not any associative learning that I'm talking about. It's quite demanding. That's why only some animals show this kind of, not a few, but not every animal definitely shows this kind of thing. I think it evolved early in evolution. As I said, something like 540 million years ago in two lineages, probably in parallel, and in another lineage 250 million years later. So this is my answer to the function question.
I have a very specific, it's bugging me, I'm going to ask a slightly nerdy technical question about the evolution of associative learning, rather complex associative learning involving instrumental conditioning, reward and punishment. And what's worrying me is that Bjorn referred earlier to the FOXP2 gene, which he said was specifically to do with instrumental conditioning and which predated the Cambrian split. And Eva has said two or three times that instrumental conditioning evolved separately, maybe in the vertebrates and the arthropods, but certainly separately again in the mollusks. So this is a question about how many times did this thing evolve?
But there is a distinction between instrumental conditioning, which is simple, and the kind of operant complex conditioning that I'm talking about.
Okay.
So instrumental conditioning, which is basically learning about your own actions, simple actions, exploratory actions in the world, is very, very, very ancient. It's not specific even to animals. So this is something that's very, very early. Especially if you're thinking about non-associative learning, also is very important. You can modulate this kind of exploratory behavior. You can bias it one way, you can bias it another way, and so on. The kind of learning that I'm talking about is not just simple instrumental learning or simple Pavlovian kind of conditioning. It requires the perception and the binding of many it requires the binding of many stimuli together, both stimuli coming from the world and stimuli coming on the body, combining this together and creating a model of prospective action leading to and a reinforcement system that takes into consideration the complexity of the animal and a memory system, dedicated memory system, that that takes into consideration the history of the learning history of the animal. So there is a lot that is required from this, and I think that this type of system, me and my colleague, think that this type of system, which is a complicated system, nevertheless can be discerned in vertebrates, in some arthropods, and in some mollusks. And therefore, if this is true, and we are looking at when these animals evolve and when the brain areas which are implementing this kind of learning has appeared on the scene, and we have some evidence from fossils about it too, even from the Cumbrian fossils, then we have to say, well, it's somewhere around the Cumbrian that this thing evolved. So that is why there is no contradiction between what I say and what Björn say. We're talking about different aspects of learning about action.
So snails, for instance, can do simple instrumental conditioning.
They can do simple associative learning. A lot of animals can do simple associative learning. Again, not all of them, by the way. There are animals that, to the best of our knowledge, and our knowledge is full of holes, we don't know that they can learn by association at all, even very simple association. There's a lot we don't know. But from what we know, some animals can learn only through very simple associative learning, as far as we know, and some animals can learn through this very, very in this complicated way, which is also associative, but requires quite a lot. You know, the difference between this associative learning and what we call cognition is not it's the same. Yeah, it's a cognitive process.
The problem with this is that if I understand Eva's concept of this complex associative learning correctly, the problem with that is that we don't really fully have all the components of the interactions between the simple forms. So the complicated forms arise, if I understand this correctly, arise from interactions between the simpler ones. I didn't get in my presentation this morning, I didn't get into those interactions, I just showed a brief outline without showing the experiments. But if that is the basis of this, then we're only beginning to understand how all this works. What it looks like right now is that the principles seem to work very similarly in arthropods and invertebrates. Very similarly. But then again, arthropods fly and a lot of vertebrates fly too, but that arose independently. So what we don't know yet, as far as I know, correct me if you found literature where this is more unambiguous than the literature I know, what we don't know yet is actually if the genetics of those interactions tell us anything about when these things diverge. That, to me, is so far unknown because those interactions are still only known to a large extent on the neuronal level, like on which structures, which brain areas are involved, but not really what kind of evolutionary processes gave rise to those interactions. To me, with my knowledge, they look so similar as if they had evolved once. And so that as if the Urobilaterian already had it, the common ancestor between arthropods and vertebrates, but that doesn't have to be the case. We find something out tomorrow and I'll eat my hat and say the opposite. So this is as far as I know but you definitely have a lot more coverage of the literature than I have in this respect of the evolutionary coverage. For me, this looks as if there is a common origin, and then it's always the question, if we find it here, did the ones in between lose it? Or was it some exaptation, some pre-adaptation that the last common ancestor had, and then it arose, it was just simpler to arise three different times, and the other ones just didn't get it? And that's a common question whatever trait you look at in evolution, and then it's always very, very difficult to make that distinction.
To the best of my knowledge, when you're looking at the genetic data, and in fact, me and my colleagues, we looked at the over 800 genes which are involved in learning that we assembled from the literature and in synaptic connections, in the formation of synaptic connections. And we found some interesting things, but we found, for example, the FOXP gene is all over the place, is everywhere, including in sponges.
Yep.
So it's not So it's clear that just looking at which genes are involved is not going to give. We saw that in vertebrates you have a very, very different profile of genes. But we know that in vertebrates there were two duplications of the genome. So it's not very surprising that this is what is found. But when you're looking, I don't think that this is not the level at which we will find the answer. Maybe we will find some kind of answer when we know where to look and when we're looking at genetic networks. As long as we don't, we just see very, very crude patterns that do not tell us this kind of, that cannot answer, this kind of questions.
Another little techie question. You said the functional organization in the vertebrates and the arthropods was very similar in a way that suggested some kind of common origin. Is it the same with the mollusks, with the cephalopods?
No, not very similar.
Good.
In the arthropods and the vertebrates, it's very similar, indeed.
So I tried to do that experiment. I tried to do the exact same experiment I do in flies, and that is very similar to the ones that a lot of people do in vertebrates in snails. But I had to leave that lab before I could do the follow-up experiments that would needed to be done. So, and the results that I got weren't as straightforward and as obvious as they were when I did the, what I thought was an analogous experiment in flies. But then again, this may only just mean that I haven't come up with the real analogous experiment that would be just as straightforward as I would expect, but it could be that Eva is perfectly right, no matter what experiment I try to design to be as analogous as possible to those in vertebrates and in arthropods, that I would never find the analogy. That's pretty much possible, I don't know.
The mollusks are very different, but I think that when you're looking at the cephalopods, the clever ones, you see a functional organization that has some similarities to that, but we really know relatively little about it.
Eva, earlier you mentioned fossils.
Yes.
How does one infer consciousness from a fossil?
You can't infer it without knowing what you're looking for, obviously. But if you think that certain brain structures are implementing certain types of learning and behaviors, and then you find these brain structures in endocasts of fossils, then you say, well, they had the structures, and it seems like, you know, if they had eyes, for example, some fossils, you see that they had the kind of complex eyes that all kinds of arthropods have. So if they had these eyes, presumably they had some kind of visual system there, which is similar. In the same way, if you have the brain structures, such as, for example, mushroom bodies, you could detect in the fossils, you say, well, probably these structures are doing what they're doing in extant animals. You can't be sure, but it's a fair inference.
Okay, let's take a few questions from the audience on this topic then of the evolution of consciousness.
Hello. Yeah. Regarding evolution and consciousness, so I have to ask, what about plants and trees specifically, because they have a very complex root network, you know, very fine roots that are connected through very fine networks of fungi, and they communicate, at least they communicate through chemical signals, right? And send out information regarding how to distribute very limited resources regarding water and nutrients and things like that. And of course, you know, if you compare it to humans, it all seems so primitive, but from a longitudinal perspective, it's amazing. It's almost like as if they're making decisions. So how does, you know, does this contribute to the conversation? I mean, can it? Yeah, thanks.
It absolutely can.
Also a question from the row in front, I think.
Hi there. My question is to do with whether consciousness could evolve in artificially intelligent agents, and if so, would it have to be embodied in some sort of robotic form, or could it happen in an abstract computer, say?
Great, thanks. And let's also go to the very end of the fifth row from the back.
So unfortunately, I'm going to mention machine learning, but I don't want to get into the question of whether or not machines can be conscious. I want to harken back slightly to the relationship between intelligence and consciousness. So we know that intelligence has some relationship to consciousness because there are things that I am conscious of because of something that I've learnt, which I won't be conscious of without some version of intelligence. So a scientist is conscious of the fact that they're seeing an electron. Right. When we look at something like machine learning, where we are trying to mimic intelligence of some sort, what we discover is that, as Bjorn mentioned, these sorts of things are things that get grown. Our notion of intelligence is something which gets grown using fairly simple processes, which seem to mimic quite a lot what Ava's mentioning in terms of, say, fairly simple learning algorithms. And it seems to me as if the link or the path that we're taking in intelligence, which itself is a kind of evolutionary process, leads itself fairly naturally to the kind of process which we're seeing Ava arguing for.
Great, thanks. So three really good questions. About, a question about plant consciousness, about whether consciousness can be realized in non-biological artificial substrates, and a question about how all this relates to machine learning and whether that could be a way of creating consciousness. Ava, would you like to come in on this?
Well, I have a very great respect for plants and their abilities, cognitive abilities. I think that there was a recent paper that showed that plants can actually learn by association. It's not a complex associative learning. It's a very, very simple one, and it's probably a specific kind of sensitization. But nevertheless, it is associative learning. And we know about communication and so on. So I think... I think that this kind of processes are that we have to look at this, and it's fascinating, and we have to study this. From our point of view, the kind of learning and the kind of complexity that we demand from the cognitive system is greater than that, and we think that in order for this to happen, you need something that works quite quickly and integrates things quite quickly. And as far as we know, from the biological world, not the artificial kind of artifact world, it requires something like a nervous system. So I have no reason to think that plants are conscious according to the criteria that we adopt. There are other people who think that every living being is conscious, and every living being that learns is conscious. And I think cells can learn too. There is a kind of epigenetic learning, for example, in cells. So it's relatively simple. It's not complex associative learning, of course, but nevertheless, it's quite impressive. So this is my answer to that. According to our criteria, plants are not conscious. About robots and about machine learning, what I'm interested in is in the only consciousness that we know exists, which is biological consciousness, and it is realized by biological mechanisms. In the same way that I'm interested in when I'm thinking about, for example, capacities of living organisms, such as unlimited heredity, the ability to have technically unlimited number of variation, which is realized by DNA and by complex machinery of the cell and so on and so forth. I'm thinking about biological systems. I'm not thinking about genetic algorithms, which also can realize this unlimited heredity in an artificial system. And I will not think that the computer chip is alive because it has this system. But I think that the kind of implementation... So I think that the implementation of the way that, for example, heredity is implemented by living organisms, the way that very complex cognition is implemented by animals, this kind of implementations are the type of implementations that in the one case lead to life and in the other case lead to consciousness. You can take the basic system and implement it, but I think that implement it in a machine, but this will not make the machine into a conscious machine, just in the same way that it will not make the computer chip into a living system, or a game of life into a living system. Yes, a computer game into a living system.
So I take the different view on the machines. I see no reason in principle why machines shouldn't be conscious. Now, you might think, look, this is a abstract, indefinable question. I'm inclined to turn it round the same way I did with the animals and put to you that if you met a machine that could respond like a human being consistently over time, it would become clear to you that you owe this being moral concern. You wouldn't raise the question of whether it was conscious. Your first thought would be, this is a being I'm interacting in, it's owed some moral concern. And, I mean, take an extreme case. Imagine Commander Data that is a machine but has been designed to behave just like us. No, I mean, if that person came in here, right, you would be you'd be a monster if you didn't treat it as a moral equal on the grounds it was made of different chemistry.
We don't really do that with our, you know.
Well, I think we're not. I mean,
our computers, we curse at our computers as if they were human beings.
I think you might think, well, Commander Data looks like. I don't think that's important. I think you're absolutely right. I don't think it's that far off that we will have systems that we will start regard as beings that have to be treated morally in a certain way. But it'll be very difficult. I don't expect to see it, but I'm sure a lot of you will see it in your lifetime. This will become a real issue.
I think that it is possible that we shall have conscious robots one day. God help us. God help them, especially, the way that we will treat them. Yeah. I mean, it's a very, very big worry.
Yeah.
But I think that in order to implement such a thing, to build this kind of thing, it will be very, very much more complex, in my opinion, than what we imagine. It's not just the implementation of a kind of, even the kind of learning that I'm talking about. It would need... I talked with roboticists, for example, and some of them were talking about the kind of how a robot should be embodied, what kind of materials would be necessary. Is it flexible kind of soft materials how many little computers there would be in this robot? Maybe millions of little computers that will be like sensors and a lot of bits that will be like effectors. I mean, it is beginning to simulate a kind of living organisms almost. So I don't know how it will be implemented. Maybe there are simpler ways than the ways that I can imagine. But I think that we're very far from it at the moment. And I think that it is a more demanding task than we imagine. I think that the kind of integration that we require from so many cells, from so many sources, is part of the story. And this will have to be simulated too. I don't think it... I think it will happen. But unfortunately for them...
So we're more or less out of time. Have we made a bit of progress? I'd like to think that, if nothing else, we've built a few bridges between neuroscience, evolutionary biology, and philosophy. So let's thank our speakers for a really interesting...